Hello and welcome to the Sushi, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name is Paul Malik. I am the Courier's political editor and I'm joined from colleagues from the Person Journal in Edinburgh this morning. We have the P&J's political editor, Andy Phillip, and the P&J's investigations editor, Callum Ross. Good morning, chaps. How are we both today? Are we well?
Very
good, Paul, yeah.
Very well indeed.
Same magic. Right, let's get cracking into it because we are in the middle of the election of our lives, some have said. Others suggest that maybe it's just another election that's happening on the first Thursday of May this year. Regardless of which, it is a very different election, none more so than the fact that the manifesto was launched this week with videos and Zoom chats, which have become the norm for quite a lot of us, but it's still a bit odd knowing that we're not face-to-face with politicians and spads and asking little bits about manifesto detail, instead watching a giant TV screen and seeing the pledges being made out in real time. Andy, you were covering the SNP's launch this week, and I think it's fair to say that there is quite a lot of spending promised over the next parliament should the SNP get into power. What have been the sort of larger manifesto pledges from the Nats this week?
Nicola Sturgeon made a very expensive set of ambitious promises, but the thing that raised a lot of eyebrows was the fact that there will be no tax rate or band increases to help pay for it. So, you know, the question clearly, how can we afford all this good stuff, this free stuff? There's an extra 20% being spent on the NHS. There's huge infrastructure spending tag of about $33 billion over a number of years. We're increasing healthcare and our old favourite, closing the attainment gap in schools. All of this while we're rebuilding the country out of a pandemic and the biggest economic crisis that we've seen for, well, in living memory for me anyway. And we're also going to have an independent state at the end of it all. So, you know, we've got to find the money somewhere, and it's not exactly the cheapest set of plans that she's put on the table.
So they're managing to do this without raising taxes, and it's fair to say there's been a few economists, neutral or otherwise, have said that it's not actually tax rises, but it's actually tax cuts in long term, because if you're increasing spending and not pushing taxes up or not increasing how much higher earners are contributing, then there's going to be a little bit of, not to dare to say deficit, but you know, there's going to be a shortage in where the money's coming from. Have they been able to say where they hope to get this extra cash so they can make these commitments?
No, that would be far too easy. The IFS, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, were quite dry, I thought, in their analysis, their snap analysis straight afterwards, where they sort of noted that there would be tight trade-offs, which I think is a very polite way of saying something's going to have to give. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there, more universal kind of social security welfare benefit. I mean, they're even scrapping NHS dentistry, for example. These are not cheap. And I think Nicola Sturgeon said about an extra 100 million, you know, to cover the gap there and then allow for increased demand. So, yeah, the answer given was that the SNP had already tweaked the tax and rates and bands to make the better off pay a little more, and that would be fine, and it's all been costed. Clearly, her political opponents were straight on the press releases afterwards, voters being duped and there's giant holes in it and all this kind of stuff. I asked Nicola Sturgeon about the reaction yesterday as well, and she was remarkably strong in her comeback, calling her opponents infantile for suggesting that she'd not lived up to previous promises and now had set out a whole new shopping list. So, it's hard to see where you go from that if the opponents are infantile and no one can quite work out whether it's affordable or not.
I mean, because I think it's fair to say, I mean, the last government, she did say, judge us on our record in education, and that attainment gap really hasn't closed to the significant levels that they promised, has it?
No. John Swinney, the education secretary, claimed some success in having narrowed it a little bit. But pretty much every observer looking at it would say that the gap is still too big. The problem is when people go to judge the government on their record, you know, they keep voting for the government. And so what is the opposition doing wrong as well? If they're, you know, they're pointing out where they see mistakes, but people are judging Nicola Sturgeon on record. She's streets ahead in the polls. So, you know, it would appear that it's enough as far as the election is concerned.
And we had quite the interesting exclusive earlier this week regarding attempts to stop depopulation or population shrinkage on more rural islands. Was it, you get offered £50,000 to stay on a beautiful, picturesque Scottish island, is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of detail to come on that, but so far, at least we know that it would apply to any island that where depopulation is or population decline is considered a risk. There would be obligations on successful applicants. I think there's about 100 of these support packages being lined up to 50,000. It would involve perhaps helping with property, getting started in business, and then there would be obligations for you to stay and work on the island for a set time, or how it would work will come down the line. It got quite a strong reaction. There's it's an interesting talking point, at least. Other people pointing out that, well, better ferries, you know, better public services and more funding in more remote and rural areas should have been done quicker and better already. But it is, they have put out quite a lot of reports and independent reports recently on the problem of fragile communities, and also looking at what we've learned as a country through the pandemic with more remote working. Can you transform disused buildings into places where people can come together and work without having to commute? Can you, you know, being away from the central belt isn't as difficult for employment as it maybe once was.
Yeah, because I mean, that was even MSPs, SNP MSPs in these more remote age regions, you know, people like Gail Ross, etc. They had mentioned the just sort of inaccessibility of being able to represent your constituency and stay there, but also, you know, have that expectation to go down to the central belt as well.
Gail Ross is a good example because she argued loudly for access to remote working for the Scottish Parliament and was told that we can't do that, it's impossible. And then lockdown came along, and necessity being the mother of all invention, she's suddenly finds that she can work remotely, but she'd already decided to call it a day.
I mean, you could even work in a Honda garage if you're Stuart Stevenson.
Yes, you can.
Other garages are available. You can buy other types of cars, but you know, he was his broadband went down, so he just went to his local car dealership. That was pretty ingenious. But I mean, you know, it still worked. He still got his say in whatever committee he was in that morning.
Yeah, and he worked from the back of his own car.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, when we see it, when we are on jobs and stuff like that, you know, some of the broadcasters they zoom in from the front seat of their plush broadcaster cars, don't they?
Yeah.
So there's plenty of option. That's cool. I like the idea of moving to an island for 50,000. I mean, I'd do it for less, actually. But we'll see. We'll see if we can work from Holyrood remotely. It might make the podcast a bit difficult if I'm just swanning about on a beach all day. Now, the Lib Dems also launched their manifesto. In fact, they're in the process of doing it right now. It was we had a few early looks at it in the Courier and Press and Journal this morning. Willie Rennie's been out flipping burgers on Marine Drive in Edinburgh, doing what he can to get his photo taken. I think it's fair to say when we were looking at the some of the pledges that came that were sort of trailed with us last night, in particular in the Courier, we looked at carers and unpaid carers and provisions to make sure that those that are entitled to payments and benefits do receive their payments and benefits. It's almost half in the Courier patch of unpaid carers who are entitled to payments and benefits haven't actually taken any on in the last year or two, which is an issue that the Lib Dems are wanting to highlight and raise. But I get back to this. I think it's fair to say that the Lib Dems are they're not making anything about promising what they would do should they get into government. But what they're doing is showing what they want to bring to the table should the MSPs be elected. Would you say that's fair, Callum? You know, it's what they want the government to compromise with for their support and their continued support in government.
I think so, Paul. I mean, you never know, obviously, in politics these days. Maybe the Lib Dems will be the kingmakers and end up in coalition government or holding the balance of power some way. But I mean, that looks unlikely at the moment. They don't get on particularly well with the SNP. In fact, it's quite interesting that in the manifesto they're very, very deliberately saying the key line is that they will put the recovery first, not independence. So they are still putting their opposition to another independence referendum right at the forefront of their manifesto. I said, hoping to speak to Willie Rennie in the next hour or so to ask him a bit more about these proposals. The manifesto has 50 kind of top lines. There's some interesting stuff in there. Free childcare for two-year-olds. There's the party's obviously made a big big focus on mental health services in the last parliament, and they're continuing that, suggesting that 15% of new health spending should go on mental health in the next parliament. But yeah, I mean, you're right. This isn't a party that's preparing for government, so they're really kind of setting out the areas they will fight for. Maybe in some cases there might be scope to influence the legislation and do deals here and there, but they're just really setting out the priorities they would fight for if they get MSPs elected on May the 6th.
I suppose that is a good way of looking at it. It's proactively putting forward, you know, here's what we want to set out, and here's what we can hope to deliver. 15% of spending on mental health. 50% of the 15% of the overall health budget on mental health. Sorry, Kelly.
New health spending. They said. You know, I expect that be kind of increase in health spending. 15% of it should go on mental health, I think. Which you know, a lot of money goes in health, so that's probably a large sum, but whether it's enough, I don't know.
And it's very important that our readers in our Savoration poll that we took just before the campaign got underway said that spending on the NHS and spending on mental health services was one of their top concerns ahead of actually economy and independence. I noticed that the Tories as well, they wanted a spending commitment of 10%. Should they get into power, that's what they've promised, as well as bringing the World Cup finals to Scotland in 2030. I don't quite see how bringing a football final to Scotland helps mental health, but it would be nice to think that Hampden could host the 2030 World Cup final. But I think by that point, we'll all be a wee bit too old to maybe feature in it, wouldn't we?
Sadly.
One of a number of barriers, I think.
We can but dream. We're just going to take a little break now. Here is an ad from one of our sponsors.
Get the facts and analysis you need about the things that matter to you this Holyrood election with DC Thompson Media. Our groundbreaking data research, video bulletins, independent opinion and expert reporting from our dedicated politics team is now yours free for 30 days. That's right, 30 days of free, unlimited web access to The Courier or The Press and Journal to help you make an informed decision this May. New customers only, you can cancel at any time. Sign up at thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed.
Now, Callum, you've been paying attention to another battle that's been erupting sort of on the fringes of this election campaign. The UK government has decided to take the Scottish government a challenge, some legislation that was put through just at the end of the last parliament regarding the UN Human Rights Act and the right of the child. I think it's fair to say it's quite a complicated subject. Can you talk us through it and try and sort of level out just what's happening between Westminster and Holyrood and why it's such a contentious issue.
Yeah, that's right, Paul. It was on Monday, actually, and election campaigning was still generally suspended following the death of the Duke of Edinburgh. But then this story kind of jolted the parties back onto a campaign footing in a way when it broke in the afternoon. It was basically confirmation from the UK government that they would ask the Supreme Court to rule on whether the Scottish Parliament had acted within its powers or not when it passed two bills last month. One of the bills enshrined the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child into Scots law, while the other did the same with the European Charter of Local Self-Government. The UK government insisted its concern was not really in relation to the substance of the legislation. It was more about whether Holyrood was legally allowed to pass these laws because, you know, parts of them, it was argued, could have implications for the UK government and limit its ability to legislate in these areas. But, you know, Nicola Sturgeon and others obviously seized on it, calling the move jaw-dropping and morally repugnant. And, you know, on the face of it, it really was a gift to the all of the other parties other than the Conservatives, a real open goal. You're 3 weeks out from an election and the UK government takes the Scottish Parliament to court for trying to protect the rights of children. It looks terrible and kind of plays into those preconceived notions that Tory ministers at Westminster are sort of desperate to limit and take away Scotland's powers and frankly, some people think of them as the nasty party, and now they don't even want children to have legally protected rights. So there are plenty of this comes at a time, obviously, when there's plenty of other negative headlines coming from Westminster that aren't potentially helping Douglas Ross and the Scottish Conservatives. We've got questions over David Cameron at the moment, and also today we've been hearing more about more questions about Matt Hancock and contracts that have been awarded down there. But in terms of the Supreme Court issue, over the subsequent days, you know, we've heard from a few legal experts that have kind of put the situation in a bit more context and really kind of highlighted that this is the way that questions over the scope of devolution should be tested. That's what they've argued. At the end of the day, the system of government in Scotland is highly complex. There's two different governments legislating, and there's bound to be these kind of issues thrown up from now and again in terms of which government has competence in which area. And also, you know, while the optics are not great, and the matter will be raised throughout the campaign with the Tories, as we saw with the STV leaders' debate earlier in the week, in reality, it probably only reinforces existing perceptions, I would imagine. I'm not sure a huge number of votes will change as a result of it, but it is hard to see it all being particularly helpful for Douglas Ross and the Conservatives.
And you touched upon that there. I mean, it's not the only thing that Douglas Ross has really sort of been concerned with this week. You noted the debates. His tone did seem to change. Did you watch the debates?
I watched it, yeah.
Yeah. Can't live without TV debates.
I watched it, but only because someone higher up told me that I had to watch it and write about it. So I watched it and wrote about it.
Did it change your mind?
It reminded me to go and vote. So I suppose that was a good thing. You know, it reaffirmed what dates you had to get your postal votes in for. So, yeah, I suppose you can say it did change my mind. But that's not the only thing Douglas Ross has sort of gotten stuff into hot water again this week. We've had the resurfacing of some comments he made back when he was a councillor on the planning committee. Callum, you know, you and I had a wee look at this week regarding gypsy travellers and Romany travellers. And then there's still the issue as well that you know, Ruth Davidson is appearing. She's not running for office. She's not running for a seat this year. She's going down to the House of Lords once this is all done and dusted. But she still seems to be front and centre of a lot of the Tory, you know, leaflets and photo shoots, doesn't she? Here's a weird one I was thinking about the other day. Right, okay, Douglas Ross. He was the first, probably only Scottish Tory MP to back Boris Johnson back way back when, if you remember, when Boris Johnson was running to be Prime Minister. And then since then, Douglas Ross has made it his thing to sort of try and say the opposite of whatever Boris has said about Scotland. But do you think if it wasn't for Boris, Douglas probably wouldn't be leader of the Scottish Tories at the moment?
Probably that's right, because Ruth Davidson was in a sticky situation all because of Boris Johnson and Brexit. It was for those reasons that she sort of decided that she couldn't really carry on. It was just, there was too many awkward questions to answer. And so she stepped back, and that set off in train a fairly difficult time for them with Jackson Carlow, who then had to just sidestep after a wee conversation up in Moray. And now Douglas Ross is there with Ruth in the background, or the foreground still.
Yeah, it's an odd one. It's almost can't live without each other.
I think he's got a tough job, doesn't he, Douglas? I mean, Ruth Davidson was obviously quite popular. She led the party to significant gains, and they kind of were able to cash in on that kind of pro-UK vote at the expense of Labour and others. But, you know, he's not as visible, he's not as well known, as well liked as Ruth Davidson. And, you know, there's a perception that he's not been having the best of campaigns so far, but these, you know, you never know what's actually going to happen on the day in terms of when the votes are counted, and there's still a couple of weeks to go as well.
I mean, our extra large surveyation poll that we took, and we have mentioned, and I'm mentioning again just for good favour, showed that Ruth Davidson was the second most popular politician behind Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland. Douglas Ross, Anna Sauer, and Willie Rennie and Patrick Harvey all had roughly the same popularity of around 16%. Nicola Sturgeon stormed ahead. She was about 53% sort of approval or serious approval. And then Ruth Davidson was the closest to her behind that, 30-40% sort of approved or semi-approved of what she did. So, you know, 2 years on after her resignation, she still does leave cast a huge shadow over anyone that's going to try and replace her. I was wondering, do you think if Douglas comes third, Andy, in the election, do you think he'll stick out his full term at Holyrood? Because he's likely to get on the list, isn't he? But do you think he'll stick on a full term? I mean, he's dropped out before, hasn't he?
Yeah, if the Tories fall back to third and Anas Sarwar leapfrogs Labour back into second position after just taking on the leadership job there, I mean, that would be more than just a setback for the Conservatives. I can't see how Douglas Ross would want to lead that kind of a group. And he's got no intention of standing down from Westminster. So he could, I mean, I'm just guessing, but he could quietly shuffle off the Highlands and Islands list, and the next person steps into his shoes and takes his seat in Parliament in Edinburgh. And they have yet another leadership round and job done again. So yeah, his position is not really that secure. That's what I'm saying.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I think we shall call it a day, because we've got plenty more to go and investigate and look at in the world of Scottish politics. The election draws ever nearer. I've been Paul Malik. Thank you to Andy Phillip and Callum Ross for joining us once more for the Stooshy. Still the same, still the best, still the original, still the one you should be looking out for on all of your politics podcast providers. Thanks for joining us. Goodbye.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshie or follow Stooshie Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.